This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Play the play on the show.
We're into my new pet subject. I love sports physiology. Like, it's the thing that I have become most interested in recently, how you manipulate or control performance. Here, 253, Bjorn Borg was the king at slowing his heart rate down. Tennis player. Says, Danny, you can learn to control the mechanisms causing the rapid heart rate, but you can't just say heart slow down. He's right about that. Like, you can't just focus because if I think my heart rate will slow down and make it do it. But you can use techniques.
Okay.
You can use, whether it's deep breathing, whether it's meditation. Like, there are different things you can do that will affect the heart rate. Like, you can. It's not something that's entirely outside your control.
That texter's comment right there, that's my biggest obstacle, I guess, to actually believing it. And my own personal experience. You go to the doctors, you get your heart rate measured. My heart rate goes up, it spikes whenever, because I hate the feeling of my pulsing blood. And it goes up.
You need to learn to relax.
And I do the deep breathing and I do all of that. But a couple of people have texted in. Listen, I am now open to the idea that it's possible, but I don't know that it's necessarily possible for every single athlete and every single human being, because I think they're all wired in different ways. And as one texter pointed out, I didn't probably try as hard as I needed to in those situations.
It's Danny and Gallant. I've got a couple other tennis players I'll use of examples on how to spike your heart rate to increase performance. We'll get to that after Brock Heward is here joining us for Blue 42.
Here we go.
This is Blue 42.
We're going to go red, right, tight, close, sprint left, GU corner, half back, flat, on two. Ready, right.
Now here's your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Blue 42!
Good morning, Brock. How are you now?
Good morning, Paulie. I think I've listened to that open, 692 times. And it irritates me every time because I messed up the call. It's red, right, tight, close, C left. I left out the C left. That's the motion out of the backfield, sprint left, G. U corner, halfback, flat. So how could the halfback get in the flat without the motion? So totally screwed that thing up. I apologize.
Your heart rate going up for that. Do you have any strategies to help lower said heart rate?
Are we talking about clutch again? Is that what we're talking about?
We have been talking about just ways that you can naturally slow your heart rate down. Because I am skeptical of the ease with which some are describing its potential. But let's shift. Let's talk about an ex-Seahawk who has probably made the Chiefs' heart rate rise. Frank Clark has now been arrested for two gun charges over the last 3 months, the latest of which involves an Uzi, the one 3 months before, a rifle and a loaded pistol.
Come on, you got to tell the whole story. An Uzi, a duffel bag, and a Lamborghini SUV.
Yes. The latter exists, and I think Danny and I are both surprised that there are Lambo SUVs.
There are Lamborghini SUVs. Titus is a car nut, and he points it out to me when he sees it on the road. So,
okay.
Yeah, there are Lamborghini SUVs, and you know, there's a couple things that jump out to me in this story. Number one, it is these 5 weeks that John Schneider and GMs around the NFL and coaches get the most nervous and sweaty palms. It was during these 5 weeks that they told Malik McDaniel and his family and all the rookies, hey, listen, you know, these are the most dangerous 5 weeks of your life as rookies. The first time you have a ton of money in your life, you have a ton of freedom, you're going to have people coming out of the woodwork. These 5 weeks are the ones that keep those people in management up at night for reasons just like this. Frank Clark is obviously not a rookie. Frank Clark has made a ton of money the last few years. And I guess the other kind of parallel story, and we hear this a bunch, and I've heard it from a lot of different executives, is that money makes guys weird. And we watched Earl Thomas kind of change before our eyes. And money can change you and make you paranoid. Money can make you fearful. And money can, you know, bring some bad characters out of the woodwork. And, yeah, I think, unfortunately, for Frank now, there's a couple incidents, and you got an Uzi in your back seat. You're going to have to answer to a lot of questions, whether that's criminally or whether that's Mr. Goodell in Park Avenue in New York as well.
I like to play this game when these incidents happen, where it's like, how could this have reasonably occurred? Right? And come up with a scenario to say, like, what is the most charitable way in which this could have happened? And what becomes tough in a story like this is if you're like, hey, Frank Clark just really likes guns. He happened to have an Uzi. He didn't really understand all the rules about having an Uzi or how you transport it or whether you can have it in a duffel bag in your Lamborghini. It's just that this is more a crime of ignorance than it is of... That goes out the window when you're like, he was cited for gun charges back in March. Like, that's usually a pretty clear sign to someone of like, hey, it requires a specific kind of responsibility. If you're going to own a gun, that's fine. You can do that in this country. But you have to follow rules. And it becomes a little bit harder to say, like, oh, he was just innocently going to a study class and happened to be pulled over by an overly observant officer when you know that this is the second gun charge in about 3 months.
Yeah, and what did he say? It's his security guys? You didn't even know about it. I think that was the explanation. Was either wasn't me, Jay. It wasn't me.
Who's your fall guy?
That's not a good explanation. Unbeknownst to me, someone was transporting an Uzi in my back seat. Like, that doesn't make me feel better about the judgment that went into this certain occurrence of, yeah, that's not better. Not better, Frank.
You think that gets Andy Reid's heart rate up when he gets that phone call yesterday?
Oh, yeah. He's out of Hawaiian shirt mode as soon as he hears that phone call.
Question two. Brock, you texted something last night that brought a smile to my face as I'm going about making my plans to go to Ann Arbor for the Huskies game against the Wolverines. Phil Steele, a legendary college football prognosticator, accountant. He's one of the deans in college football. Listed the Huskies atop his list of surprise teams ahead of such luminaries as Wisconsin and USC. Why are the Huskies a candidate to be a surprise team?
I think there's a number of reasons, and Phil still will tell you that he has the most accurate preseason book in the last 20 years. More accurate than maybe that scribe that you read to me yesterday, Danny, that was hoping Daryl Taylor will play better. That Phil Steele does his homework and has for a lot of years. He looks at a lot of different numbers, and it was in 2016, the last time the Huskies went to the national semifinal for the playoff, that he picked them in 2016 as his surprise team. There's a number of metrics to go into it. Returning starters go into it. Yards per play versus yards per play against goes into it. Got a bunch of different numbers, but when he crunched them all in 2016, it was the Huskies that he thought would be his biggest surprise team. And in 2021, going into this season, he picked the Huskies of all teams from around the country for those very same reasons. You return 18 starters. The starters you do lose are in the secondary. A place that's been a strength of development and growth in that program, looking at Jimmy Lake and the people that he recruits and the eye that he has to develop that position more than any other. You return every offensive line starter, you tight end, a bunch of production at the running back and receiver. So, you know, outside of, I think, the defensive line, as far as the position groups, he loves the Huskies' defensive room, the defensive back room, linebacker room is some of the best in the conference, the O-line. He gauges as the third best in all of college football. So there's a bunch of metrics that he points to. It's not just out of thin air that he thinks, Danny, your Huskies are going to be the surprise team in college football.
What's the biggest obstacle in their way? And I'm not necessarily talking about what's on their team. I'm talking about also who else in the Pac-12 North is going to keep them from getting there. Because we've seen last year, of course, they had that really disappointing loss to Stanford, who for whatever reason has their number.
The Huskies have to beat the Nerds. The Huskies have to beat the Nerds this year. They have to beat the Nerds.
They do. And by the way, I think Phil Steele, another reason for you, if you enjoy, you know, putting some of your own shekels on the line, Phil Steele had Stanford third in the Pac-12 North. Remember, there's still a bunch of places in Vegas thinking Stanford's going to win 3.5 games. So I think that's about one of the best bets out there.
Interesting. People sleeping on the Nerds?
3.5, Danny. I think if you go online, you can go check that out. 3.5 wins for a David Shaw that I believe has averaged 9 over the course of his career. There's been some bumps the last couple of years, but there is no way that I can envision a David Shaw team and those Nerds winning 3.5 games.
Question three. Brock, I saw another trophy offseason headline coming out of Los Angeles. Sean McVay on Matt Stafford. Stafford, even better than advertised, which of course I would hope is happening when it's practice that's taking place in shorts and not going up against serious defenses, pass rushers and all that jazz. But who's going to help their respective team take the bigger leap offensively? Is it going to be Matt Stafford with the Rams, or is it going to be Shane Waldron as Seahawks offensive coordinator?
Well, I think it will be easier for Matt Stafford. I think you've got an easier transition in that way with a system that's set up to bludgeon you in the run game, get to play action, gets a lot of pretty easy completions, got a good old line, talented young running back, plenty of pieces at receiver and Woods and Kupp. So I think, oh, and by the way, one of the best defenses in all the NFL with Aaron Donald and Jalen Ramsey and everybody else. So I think it will be an easier transition for Matthew Stafford that he says, oh my gosh, this is what football can be like. Oh man, this is easy when I don't have to throw it 700 times and the whole burden falls on me because my defense is pathetic and I don't have haven't had a 1,000-yard rusher since Reggie Bush was a Detroit Lion like a decade ago. So I think it's going to be an easier transition for Matthew Stafford. I know Shane Waldron's got DK and Tyler and one of the best QBs going, but this is first time calling plays. This is doing it under the watch of Pete Carroll, you know, who's still going to play a significant role in some of that play calling and game management and everything else. So I think in that scenario, Mr. Gallant, I think it will be an easier transition for Matthew Stafford.
Brock, McVay is playing this all wrong because he's saying things he doesn't need to say that only have the possibility of backfiring.
He's done this before, too.
Right, and that sort of... No, it is. This is what young coaches do. They allow themselves to get so hopped up on their own optimism and belief that things are going to be better that they start saying things that look really bad in retrospect. I feel now more firmly than ever that Sean McVay's coaching tenure at the Rams is tied to whether or not Stafford succeeds. He's not going to get to pick another quarterback. It is ride or die with Matthew Stafford. And if Stafford doesn't work out for whatever reason, whether it's injury or performance, I don't think McVay gets to pick the next one.
Yeah, I think I'm in line with you there. You better be careful when you overpromise that this guy is even better than you thought, right? And because then all of a sudden, man, you underdeliver in any way, it's going to come right back at you. And, you know, I think it's a whole lot better to go the other route. I think that guy in New England did that with the GOAT for 20 years. I don't think you ever heard him say those things about Tom Brady. I don't think as much as Pete loves Russell, even when Russ was winning Super Bowls and, you know, being miraculous, you know, there was never this just gushing like that in that scenario, and especially when a guy hadn't even played a snap for you. So likewise, I think this does show a little bit of immaturity. It just does show still some of that youth. And it puts an even, I think, bigger expectation level, bigger target on both of those two to deliver this year for Demoff and Sneed and an owner in a new stadium that, you know, more than anything wants to win that championship.
Are you a Stafford guy? I always forget because Stafford for years has been sort of the quarterback's quarterback. Everybody loves, like, Aaron Rodgers, who's, oh man, some of the throws that Nine makes are absolutely unbelievable. Matthew Stafford, like, people love him. Are you a Stafford guy?
I think he's very gifted. I think he's very, very talented. But I am concerned just, you know, from the neck up of handling the entirety of the game. Now, McVay keeps it simple. We know that. We've listened to that. We've heard it all mic'd up. He loves to give his QB all of the answers. He puts a ton of that responsibility on himself. So if there is going to be a place for Matthew Stafford to finally over-deliver with a bunch of talent, it is going to be, I think, in this situation with the Rams. So I love this fit. I do probably fall on that side as a guy that believes he's got one of the five best arms in the game, makes it look easy, throwing a football, as very few can. Probably Josh Allen, Russell Wilson on that list with Mahomes and Rodgers, and Stafford's going to be in that top five for me. And this is a system fit that really doesn't give him any excuses anymore.
What's interesting for Stafford with me, Brock, is the amount of injuries that he has suffered, he is a lot older than 33. I mean, he's been in the league for quite some time. I think that body has just taken an absolute pounding in the last 2 years. I mean, he's had multiple back injuries over the course of them. But I also just wonder about the transition for a quarterback from a team that has been historically inept to a team where there actually are expectations. Walk us through that. Yeah. What is that kind of a transition like? Because we don't traditionally see that in the NFL where a quarterback's leaving a bad situation for a good one while he is a quarterback that is respected by most of the league.
Well, I think here's the biggest one in that regard. And I remember talking to my brother about this, you know, in the different spots he was with the Dolphins when they had an elite defense, right? And how much easier the game was because you knew if you made, you know, 4 or 5 plays, you're going to have a chance to win. And it's all about winning in the NFL, something that he's not done at a high clip, something that gets thrown back at his face all the time of his career record and no playoff win and everything else. He has an elite, elite defense that's going to give him the ball back. And he's going to know, and he's smart enough to know this, that I don't have to make every single play as I did in Detroit. The wins and losses were really all about him. He did not have a run game. I wasn't joking with you. I had Detroit, I think, 2 or 3 times last year. And I believe it was all the way back to, like, 2013 was the last 1,000-yard rusher that the Lions have ever had, and that was Reggie Bush. So he's never had the support of a run game. He's never had the support of a great elite defense given the ball back. And, you know, he's played for an organization that has been the purgatory of the NFL in many ways. So I think you just kind of feel a sense of release, to be honest with you, Paul. Like playing with a great golf, you know, if you're playing in a golf tournament or a golf scramble, and all of a sudden, you know, you don't have to be the ringer on every hole and you got people helping you. And man, I don't have to hit, you know, 35 shots today to carry the team. It gives me a chance to, I think, feel a sense of release and freedom. And I'm sure he does. And I'm sure he's so, you know, equally excited to get this season going.
He is Brock Heward. He joins us Mondays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays. He might not let it on, but he's just excited as I am about the idea that Washington's going to be the top surprise in college football. Brock, thank you so much. We'll talk to you
soon. Thanks, Brock.
Danny, I'm going back to college football, so you're right. I'm totally an unbiased observer. All right,
That's right. That's right. I heard you say he called him Danny your Huskies. I was like, oh, that's funny. Brock's going to fool everybody with that one.
Love you, boys. Have a great day. See ya.
That is Brock Heward. Yeah, I wear my allegiance on my sleeve when it comes to that one. Paul, we were talking about heart rates, and I mentioned the two tennis players. Jimmy Connors would throw fits during matches. It was one of the reasons my dad hated him as a tennis player. My dad was more of an Yvonne Lendl.
Not a John McEnroe guy.
Right. He liked the more staid, the more professional. But there was, you always looked at it as, why are those guys doing that? And I'm not sure if it was deliberate on their part or not. But Connor specifically would do it to try and summon up some adrenaline. Mm. He'd let himself get mad to try and sort of ride the waves, the ups and downs of performance. And the more that we learn about athletic performance, the more we understand that there are waves, there are peaks and valleys over the course of a game, and learning to manage those and learning how to ride those and have those work in your favor is a big part of maximizing your performance. And we've always heard it of, hey, the manager gets thrown out and to fire his team up, or the basketball coach like challenges one of his players to get there. And you've got to pick your spots to do that. But there is something to that idea of it being, now that's going to come with a valley afterward when that little peak, the boost of adrenaline or the energy will wear off. But you can create situations, and some of it is about manipulating your biology, your physiology, to aid your performance.
That is something else. That, what you just said with Jimmy Connors, that sounds like something that you would see in anime. I don't know if you've ever watched Dragon Ball Z, but one of the things they do is they get mad, and then they go, oh, and then they power up like a million times over the course of the show. Like, that's the whole show.
there is part of that, and whether it was deliberate on Connor's part or he just happened to be someone that would throw a fit, and same with McEnroe, and benefit from it. Russell Wilson takes pretty much the exact opposite approach to things, which is that between plays, he tries to center.
Neutral.
And he's talked about getting back to a neutral mind. And what that is you don't want to feel like I'm so hot I can't do anything wrong, But you also don't want to feel like, I don't know what's going on. The point between each play is to get yourself back to that neutral station. And that's what Andy McKay is talking about with Jared Kelnick. And I don't know if it's saying, hey, we don't want you to get frustrated in the box. That might not be the part of it, but there is, by the time you get set for that next pitch, we don't want you feeling any of that frustration. You've got to find a way to let that go and get back to being balanced. We don't want you riding a high. We don't want you riding a low or valleying out there. You've got to be able to find a more even keel, because in a sport like baseball, I mean, you're having hundreds of at-bats. You're having more than 1,000 swings, I would think, over the course of a year, certainly at pitches that are there. You've got to be able to maintain, as opposed to hitting peaks and valleys.
Is that compatible with someone who we believe has the confidence that Kelnick seems to have? I mean, I can't remember a young player seemingly having more. And just based off of our conversations with him last year in Peoria in spring training, just him sitting down. I mean, that's a guy who is sure that he is going to rise to the top. And this is one of those sports where it's not the same as, you know, having that confidence that Trae Young has with the Atlanta Hawks, where he's taken the Atlanta Hawks all the way to the Eastern Conference Finals, despite playing on a team that honestly is undermanned and playing a style that a lot of people have told him to stop playing. He's still so confident he's been able to sort of weather through it. This is obviously that sport being so different. It's going to make it tough for him.
Can he do it? Absolutely, man. Think about all the personality types that we've seen. Reggie Miller, the way he interacts with fans, the way he taunted people, the way that he's sort of Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant. Like, there's the idea of confidence, but what they've all got the ability to do is not let a previous mistake beat them a second time. You've got to be able to find a way when things have gone wrong for you to flush that, to let that go and not let that frustration impact your future decision making. You can't let, I'm so mad, I'm going to make up for it. You've got to find a way to let go of that.
You also have to still feel confident enough in yourself.
Yes.
To not,
but that's part of it, right?
Ben Simmons.
Like, if you're holding on to your frustration, Ben Simmons is a great example. That dude's broken right now.
Right.
Like, he passed up what should have been. He should have dunked on Trae Young.
Yep.
And the reason he did that was because he let past frustrations or fear of failure change his decision making. So he decided to pass it to Matisse Thybulle instead of trying to dunk it, because either he didn't want to go to the foul line or he was unsure about making the shot. That's the best example ever of letting that past frustration. And there, it held on to him of, like, he was timid. You can't be timid. You can't be timid, and you can't start shooting. You also can't be, because you're frustrated and you haven't made a shot, just jack up everything you get, figuring eventually these are going to start going in.
Basketball is a little different on that, though, because I think it's just a sport where you have a little bit more control, and obviously there's less failure involved. You can turn into a Ben Simmons, who is, by all accounts, outside of his ability to score, a fantastic basketball player. Great defender, great passer, everything you want, size, the length, the speed, all of those things. But for Jared Kelnick, that I'm really curious about it. If this sport is compatible with that kind of confidence, well, I guess it is, because, I mean, clearly Fernando Tatis Jr. has it. that guy could not be cockier. And I love every single bit of it. It's just a shame. I think we maybe saw Tatis and we got Tatis envy.
It's Danny and Gallant. Carl Nassib is someone who made a very brave personal declaration yesterday, something that I think we all can support and embrace. Also, some thoughts about his decision to come out and express his sexuality openly. That's next.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Carl Nassib is an NFL veteran. He's a member of the Las Vegas Raiders. He was a third-round pick. He's, 28 years old? He's been established in the league. He has a solid career. And yesterday, he made a very personal announcement in a very public way. And I think the best way to introduce this is to play the audio from a video that he posted on Instagram.
What's up, people? I'm Carl Nassib. Just want to take a quick moment to say that I'm gay. I've been meaning to do this for a while now, but I finally feel comfortable enough to get it off my chest. I really have the best life. I got the best family, friends, and job a guy could ask for. pretty private person, so I hope you guys know that I'm really not doing this for attention. I just think that representation and visibility are so important. I actually hope that like one day videos like this and the whole coming out process are just not necessary. But until then, you know, I'm going to do my best and do my part to cultivate a culture that's accepting, that's compassionate. And I'm going to start by donating $100,000 to the Trevor Project.
It's not an easy thing for anyone to do, and I can't even put myself in the shoes of that. It's very clear that Carl Nassib, based off of what he told us right there, is that he has an unbelievable support system that allows him to feel that way. We'll see if the locker room that he shares with other members of the Las Vegas Raiders feels the same way. I hope that they will. I honestly think that they will too. Maybe I'm naive in thinking that, but it's great that he felt comfortable doing that. And the reason he does something like that is not to call attention to himself. It's to make it easier for other athletes and just people feel comfortable doing something like that too.
I feel great for Carl Nassib. I'm happy that he feels secure and supported and safe enough to do this and to be open about this. I don't want to be sort of turn a blind eye to the possibility that that could change the way some people look at him, even though I think that that would be really unfortunate. Like, it takes some courage to do this and to expose and to show all of yourself. I think it is really important. Representation does matter. Showing an example and support for it, I think, really is important. I know that I'm also going to end up cringing at some of the coverage of this, because even how you phrase it, the first openly gay male athlete in American sports, that's not true. There have been tons of athletes who have been openly gay. It's never happened in a major American male team sport. And there we're getting really specific about it and creating sort of a landmark and why this is important. I think what it's important for mostly is for Carl Nassib and for the community of gay men who are aspiring or current football players, of allowing them to be their full selves and being able to embrace and accept that. I also think, and this is something I just feel personally, that the coverage of this story should in some ways defer to what Carl Nassib wants. Like, we should take some cues from him as opposed to just there any attempt to say, like, okay, how has it been now that there is an openly gay NFL player in the locker room and going and asking his teammates all of the different things? And because I think that at times, while the motivation might be to make sure that, hey, we want to make sure that he's being treated fairly and he's not being ostracized and all of those things, well, at the same time, that can create its own sort of spectacle. And I don't know. We should be respectful of what Carl Nassib wants as well here.
I think we have come a long way since before Super Bowl 22. This is an entirely different story topic. But when a reporter asked Doug Williams, the quarterback of Washington football team then, how long have you been a black quarterback?
Right.
Which is just such a dumb question. But I think we have come a long way since then. I don't think that we're going to ask those kind of callous questions. And I remember a couple of years ago on the entire matter of Colin Kaepernick thinking to myself, I think the 24-hour news cycle is such that, yeah, there would be some coverage of this if Kaepernick had been back on a team. But after like a week or two, it would have probably faded into the back. And that's, I think, what Nassib wants, and that's, I think, what will happen here in this situation. I don't think this is, you know, if this was, and this is no offense meant to Carl Nassib or anything like that, but if we're talking about, like, one of the best players in the NFL, then I think it's an entirely different story, because then there are going to be people that are perhaps pushing him to be, like, the representative of a entire community because of the high profile that he has.
I get what you're saying. I don't think it should be different, though. I think it depends on the person. And they'll talk about this in cases of harassment or other things about centering the victim. Carl Nassib's not a victim here at all. Like, he's someone that's showing incredible strength. But we should take our cues from the player. And if this was the best defensive end in the league, I get what you're saying, and I don't think you're wrong. Like, there would
there's
be
more
different
pressure on him, yeah.
There would be and more visibility. But it still shouldn't change. These sort of stories, I guess this is why it means a lot to me, and I think that it's important that Carl Nassib did this, and I want to... The important part is that he felt comfortable enough to declare and to state openly this and what that means for the community. Some people know. My stepfather and my mom... My dad died when I was in eighth grade. My mom remarried pretty quickly, and she was my stepfather, and she got divorced... It would have been they separated about 10 years after they were married, but 11 years. And for the longest time, I didn't know. I knew that the relationship had gone sideways. And it turned out that my stepfather had cheated on her. And it cheated on her with a dude. And when I found that out for the first time, because I've been really mad and I've got a lot of anger at him for a lot of other reasons, it was the first time that I really felt true sympathy for him when I found that out. He'd been raised Catholic. He'd been a Christian brother, which is sort of a male religious order in the Catholic Church. He had married my mom and taken on three kids to become a father, essentially, of the household. He tried everything he could to be straight. And he wasn't. I don't know. I haven't talked to him in 15 years. And I don't know if he's out now or how he's living or any of those sort of things. I do know that broke him. Like that broke him. And it made him do things that were awful to my mom that had long-term consequences. And I came away from that. I think it's important that people be honest because it's not about politics. It's about identity. It's not about a choice. It's about who you are. And embracing and accepting people for who they are and having them in a place where they feel safe to be able to say that is really important. So... as far as all of the long-term implications, I think we'll see it play out. I think it is important that Carl Nassib comes out and says this and feels comfortable enough to say it, not just because he feels that way, but because I think it will make it easier for other players. He's not the first gay NFL player.
No.
And I'll tell you what, he is not the first gay NFL player that guys in the locker room have known is gay. I guarantee it.
No
there's
doubt.
Way more. It's just never been public like this before. And that's in that case, this is a good step.
First, thanks for sharing that with us, Danny. Second, you know, it's in the beginning of the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And yet, for a lot of people, they don't actually authentically have that. And I want more people to feel comfortable in that. And honestly, I really think we have come a long way on that. Again, there's religious things and other things that are obstacles for some people to actually be empathetic to somebody who is going through something like this. But that's what I would ask you. Hey, is this person allowed to do what makes them happy? Because that's what our country is all about.
Yes, it is. And that's 100%. Give yourself a chance to be happy. I think you have to be your full self. And being able to be your full self and full view of everyone, I think is a really positive step. It is Danny and Gallant. We'll talk a little bit about the Mariners. Can we actually start talking about them making additions? That's coming up next.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
His voice does not often crack, but when it does, it's spectacular.
Glorious.
And there's been a lot of reason to shout over the Seattle Mariners over this past week, this homestand that resumes tonight with games against Colorado. Aaron Goldsmith is joining us, voice of your Seattle Mariners. Aaron, first of all, thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Hey, you got it, guys. Good morning to you. How are you?
We're doing very well. We're excited to hear you on the call and see this team back on the field. And we've described this, that four-game sweep of the Rays as... Kind of a high point in this rebuild. It feels like they've got some serious momentum, and we're seeing some of the fruits of the rebuilt roster.
Yeah, that was that. I don't think anybody would expect any team to sweep the Rays in four games. There's no doubt about that. I think too, when you consider the fashion in which they beat the Rays, they beat them at their own game. Essentially, when you get into a battle of the bullpens with Tampa Bay. Tampa Bay will win that almost 10 times out of 10. Maybe we didn't see it, but I think if you've been following the Rays recently, especially this year, you know that their bullpen is elite. I mean, this is what they do better than almost anybody else, is acquire arms and put them in the perfect position, it seems like Kevin Cash does almost every single time. And yet the Mariners beat the Rays bullpen three times, and we know about the three walk-off wins. So it was remarkable. It was an incredible four-game series, especially in the manner in which they did it.
And also just the lineup. It has improved over the last couple of weeks, and it's not just J.P. Crawford and Mitch Haniger, Ty France anymore. We're seeing Jake Bowers. We're seeing Shed Long contribute. I think that's been the best development that we have seen, and hopefully, Goldie, we will continue to see it.
For sure. I mean, every lineup looks better if you have at least a guy in there who is piping hot, right? And there's been times this year for the Mariners where they have not had that. And that's not just a Mariners thing. That's a baseball thing. And that happens to every lineup at some point where you got nine guys and not all nine aren't really swinging it. Well, when you have one guy, specifically your leadoff guy, who is just on red-hot fire like JP has for such a long time, and it feels like you go to the ballpark each day and you kind of say, well, there's nothing more he can do to further supplant himself as being the guy right now. And then, you know, the other night on the Steelheads throwback night when he hits the grand slam, he does something even greater than what we have seen. He hits a grand slam. Even a home run, which is not really a part of JP's game, would have stood out, let alone a grand slam. But you're right. Tom Murphy is swinging the bat much better, especially against left-handers, now that he's kind of started to get back into a flow of it. And, you know, Ty France as well. Ty had the long power drought. We really don't have a real clear idea as to how much the wrist injury zapped him, even before going on the IL. But he clearly has it back now, and we know the quality of hitter that he is when he is right. So you are seeing more consistency 1 through 9 right now out of the Mariners order. And to me, that's the story of this season for the Mariners, is at one point, could they get consistent? Because the roller coaster has been pretty severe. I mean, there have been some negative G's associated with the Mariners this year until that point. And so how quickly can they stabilize things and get things back to kind of normal baseball? And it feels like recently we've had a lot of normal baseball, which has meant for the Mariners some really winning baseball, which has been great.
We're talking to Aaron Goldsmith here on the Issaquah Pest Control Hotline. That quest for stability, I think that's really well said, because they have gone through some real ups and downs so far. They've been really resilient. They've had a ton of injuries. Aaron, looking at the broad picture of this rebuild, on the one hand, the success and the fact that they're 2 games over .500 in spite of all those injuries is borderline incredible. On the other side, a lot of the guys that we would have been waiting for and watching to break through, Evan White, Jared Kelnick, some of the younger players, Taylor Trammell he's had some moments, been inconsistent, haven't maybe been as productive. How much do you take what's happening now as a sign toward the long-term direction or potential success of this rebuild?
You know, for me, it is something that I really do feel like the Mariners want to build themselves in a lot of ways after what we saw with Tampa Bay. And with that, I mean pitching and defense. Pitching and defense. Like, to me, that was one of my biggest takeaways from the Rays series, mm-hmm. is for as progressive and forward thinking that we see the Rays be each and every year, right? They always find the new frontier. When you look at the Rays and the way they're constructed this year, it's pitching and defense. I mean, their lineup is good, but it's not a lineup that if you took away what they can do fielding and you take away what they can do throwing the ball, especially out of the bullpen, it does not scream elite postseason contender the way that it does right now. If you look in the National League, what the Giants are doing, in a lot of respects, it's pitching and defense. To me, for as progressive as the game has gotten, and that's a whole separate conversation. A lot of that's really fun. I know a lot of it's really frustrating to some fans as well. Can you field it and can you pitch it? And the Mariners, when you look at what they have done in terms of their roster construction right now, I mean, a lot of it does really feel like this is a team that wants to be a pretty elite defensive group. I mean, you have your best defender at the premium position at shortstop, and JP is very well on his way to winning another Gold Glove. Could happen. And, you know, they feel very strongly about Dylan Moore as a well above average second baseman and one of the best in the American League. The outfield can all go and get it. When Evan White is healthy, we know what Evan White is. Seager, we know what Seager is. And you can go on. And then in terms of the pitching, to me, there's not a a great coincidence that as the pitching has started to stabilize recently, the records have started to stabilize as well. I mean, when the Mariners get a starter to go at least six innings, they're 18-9 this year. They've won seven of their last nine games when their starting pitcher has gone into the sixth inning. And I'm not even talking about how many runs they're giving up. Just get into the sixth inning and let Scott not overuse his bullpen, right? I mean, what Yusei Kikuchi, to me, Yusei Kikuchi is like the most under-talked about guy in Seattle. It's what he is doing is somehow not making headlines when he's, I think he's truly been one of the best starting pitchers in the American League. He deserves to be an all-star this year, I think. So you're right. With the injuries, for sure, which a lot of teams are going through, but the Mariners are at the top of the fold of that. With the injuries, with all the youth, with people who you were expecting a lot from who maybe haven't quite gotten to that level quite yet, you still have had really good defense, and the pitching is coming around. And I don't care what year it is, that will always win you games at this level.
Aaron Goldsmith with us on the Issaquah Pest Control Hotline. You mentioned the Rays, and they're sort of the anomaly in the American League. Could you take a look at Boston and Houston and Chicago and what they are doing? They are doing it by just being as dominant as they are at the plate. I don't know if the Mariners are going to find themselves within actual realistic playoff contention over the course of the next month, just given how many teams there are in the American League that are really crushing it right now. You also have Oakland, New York, that are still hanging in that right around that wild card spot. But could you see the Mariners actually trying to add at this trade deadline, or do you think that they will very likely try to stay true to the process that they have been following for now a couple of years?
I think there is a really clear plan put in place, and I think you have to, despite the frustrations from the fan base that I certainly understand for the playoff drought, which we all know about, the one thing I think you do have to at least acknowledge and appreciate is that this organization, dating back a couple of years at this point, of course, came out with a plan. They've made it very public. This is not a plan that they're keeping close to their chest. Jerry speaks very publicly about what he is wanting to do and where he sees this club in the near term and the long term as well. And there has been nothing that has had them deviate from that plan. I mean, there were people, if you go back a couple of years ago when the Mariners won whatever it was, it felt like 18 of their first 20 games, which I know the number's not exactly right, but we all remember that hot run to begin the season. There were people who wanted to add Craig Kimbrell, who was on the market then, you know, when the Mariners were essentially a month into the season and had the best record in baseball. And the Mariners stuck to their plan. So they have mapped this thing out, and I don't think there are things that will get them to deviate from a plan, just like when you talk about prospect development as well. And even you have to think about what's best for the player and not just what's best for the big league team. And so there's a bigger picture in mind, and whatever that makes Jerry do, that's what will happen. But they have a plan, and I know they will be sticking with it.
He is Aaron Goldsmith. We love hearing you on the broadcast, Aaron, both on TV side and radio. And we're grateful for you spending the time this morning. We look forward to hearing the call tonight as the Mariners take on the Rockies, first of two games as they close out a homestand.
Thanks, Aaron.
You got it, guys. Thanks for having me. Have a good one.
That is Aaron Goldsmith, Sweet Pipes and noted frozen yogurt enthusiast.
Froyo.
Yeah. Or I guess it's soft serve. I'm sorry. It's soft serve. It's not Froyo. It's soft serve.
Wait,
if he hears that, he might. Yes. Yes. It's a very significant difference. Perhaps the text line can tell us what that difference is. You heard him talk about the big picture. How do we feel about that with the Mariners? We'll talk about it next.